My name is Ernst Spegelin. I'm the head of the Courtauld Gallery, and this exhibition, Botticelli and Treasures of the Hamilton Collection, essentially brings back to the UK some of the greatest works of art that were sold by the Dukes of Hamilton in 1882 to a museum in Berlin. And that was a very sensational sale. It caused sort of outrage and gnashing of teeth in the British art establishment, and it meant the loss for the UK of some really extraordinary treasures. So wonderful illuminated manuscripts, and perhaps most important of all, a set of 85 drawings by Botticelli illustrating Dante's Divine Comedy.
The drawings themselves haven't been coloured. Why is that?
So the drawings seem to have been intended originally to have been bound into a splendid illuminated book for one of the members of the Medici family in Florence. Most of them survive now as pen and ink outline drawings, but a small number are hand-coloured. So there is some suggestion that in an early phase of the project they were all meant to be fully coloured by hand, and that for reasons unknown was abandoned, perhaps because of technical complexities or sort of logistical challenges.
The fact that the drawings are so exquisite, they're so finely drawn, and they're so beautifully all the attention to detail is incredible. And I know that Botticelli in his later life became very religious. Is this manuscript sort of a sign of his religious devotion, or is it increasing feelings of religiosity, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think they are towards the later part of his life. He dies in 1510, and this is sort of 1480s and 90s, and certainly we know that in Florence at the time that was a particularly sort of turbulent moment with the Dominican preacher Savonarola taking over from the Medicis and his bonfire of the vanities and burning all of these books. Savonarola did tolerate Dante's Divine Comedy, you know, for its sort of religious dimensions, and it is the poem is a sort of poem of sort of yes, a pilgrimage of sort of spiritual and self-discovery and redemption. And I think, yes, it's fair to say that that Dante's illustration of that poem would also have involved such a dimension, I think, for him as an artist, pursuing a similar sort of pilgrimage as he was sort of, yes, illustrating these chapters of the poem.
Do you have illuminated manuscripts as well in the exhibition? So it seems clear, it seems obvious to almost draw comparisons between devotional labour the monks sort of put into that and Botticelli's own devotional work.
There is, and I think perhaps sort of drawing a hard and fast sort of line between the secular and the religious is to misrepresent how it would have been. And so these later parts of the Divine Comedy, where you see some of the most ravishingly beautiful of the Botticelli drawings, where it's just Dante and his sort of his love Beatrice moving through the different sort of spheres of paradise, those are, in a sort of through a secular lens, are just ravishingly beautiful, and they are about sort of the poet's love for this this woman.
They are very moving. They're very, very they're very sweet and intimate. And she's covering her face because am I right in thinking that if Dante looks upon her beauty when she smiles, he'll turn into ash?
That's exactly right, that she is so sort of radiantly beautiful and filled with sort of divine love reflected from above, that she is not able to smile on Dante. If he sees her smile, then yes, he will be turned to ash. And then as he moves through the realms, he is able to see the full sort of beauty of her face. So they are very moving, and they're very different from the earlier passages of the poem where in hell there is much more sort of anecdote and narrative, and there are lots of sort of intriguing sort of torments being suffered by the various sinners. And the poem changes then in paradise, where it becomes much more abstract. And so Dante sort of has to grapple with how to represent that, because there is very little sort of narrative to describe in the drawings. And so it's a different sort of visual language and a different pictorial strategy that you see there.
That's interesting, because the last sheet, where he's in the highest realms, yes, of heaven, yes, it's almost empty. Well, it is empty, yes, apart from the two figures. Is that because he struggled to draw on earthly comparisons?
I think you're absolutely right. So that is the last surviving drawing, where we are in what Dante calls the Empyrean, which is the very highest of heaven, where Christ is enthroned. And we have this largely blank sheet with just three tiny figures, one of whom is Christ and one of whom is the Virgin Mary, and just an outline perhaps of a sort of petal on which they're seated. And we don't know why he abandoned it at that stage. And I think one attractive notion is that he had reached the limits of representation, really, and that also sort of mirrors Dante's experience and the way the poem operates, that in a sense it is beyond the realm of words and beyond the realm of images to represent what one sees and experiences there.
I always ask this question because it always brings up interesting answers. Which is the one piece that you love the most, or the one drawing that you keep going back to, you keep looking at?
That's a difficult one. Well, I think those really sublime sort of mystical drawings at the end of the sequence of Beatrice and Dante going through the realms of paradise are beautiful and moving and profound and sort of eternal in a way. I think that some of the more gripping drawings from Inferno are also extraordinary. There is one drawing which stands out, and that is the double-sized sheet of Lucifer, the prince of darkness, sort of lodged in the very pit of hell. And he is just a remarkable sort of feat of imagination. He has six bat's wings which are beating wildly and sort of sending an icy draft through the lower regions of hell, and three grotesque sort of horned heads with which he is sort of chewing on the three arch traitors of history, Judas Iscariot and Cassius and Brutus, the assassins of Julius Caesar. And then looking closely, you see Dante and Virgil climbing onto Lucifer's sort of ice-encrusted furry pelt and making their way down his flanks, and then turning round halfway along his body and then clambering up his legs, which will lead them to the foot of the mountain of purgatory on the other side of the earth. And I think those sort of extraordinary leaps of creative imagination to visualise something like that are very remarkable.
Some of them are quite gory too, aren't they?
They are gory, and it's easy to forget that many of the characters that you encounter in the poem and in the drawings in Dante's time had only just died, so Dante had known a lot of them. There are even a few that were still alive during Dante's time, which Dante then meets, and you know, he talks to these people as he's going down through the levels of hell. And there's a lot of sort of settling of scores and an invention of very sort of, you know, grotesque punishments. There is Pope Nicholas III, who is on the eighth level of hell, stuck upside down in a hole in the ground with the soles of his feet on fire, because he has been such a sort of corrupt church official. And the corrupt sort of secular officials who are thrown into ditch of burning tar, and they sit there like frogs with their heads just sticking out, and in their sort of desperation to relieve their suffering, they occasionally sort of try and raise their backs out of this sort of burning pitch, and are then set upon by these devils who are waiting round the sort of outskirts of this pit, and heaved out onto the side and stabbed with their sort of lances. Or the punishment of soothsayers, who punishment for their presumption in having looked too far into the future, have to walk with their heads turned backwards on their bodies. So it's all, there's for those who are inclined to sort of gory detail, there's a lot there to enjoy.